Anyway, welcome this evening. First, a personal note. As a graduate student, I spent most of my time in the USA reading political science and political philosophy. I'm the chair today, by the way, in case you don't know me, David Held. But there were two British sociologists who inspired me then, this was some 25 years ago, and who continue to inspire my work and thought and reflections and politics today. And both those British sociologists are here this evening. The first is our former director of the OLSE, Anthony Giddens, who's back this evening, so welcome to him. And the second, formerly at Essex and the LSE, is Professor Michael Mann. So let's have a warm welcome to him. Michael Mann is currently Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles. His major works, and they are, if you know them, really seriously major works in thickness and in quality, include the prize-winning series, The Sources of Social Power, Volume 1, A History of Power from the Beginning to 1760 AD, and Volume 2, The Rise of Classes and Nation-States, 1760 to 1914. He is presently working on the third volume, Globalizations, with an S, which covers the most recent period of world history. If that is not enough, he tells me that he has two books currently in press. Fascists, which will be published by Cambridge University Press in 2004, and The Dark Side of Democracy, Explaining Ethnic Cleansing, again, Cambridge University Press next year. But if that is not enough, he's here tonight to speak about yet another book which has just published, his new book, Incoherent Empire, a devastating account of how the US wields power but not authority in a fragmented international order, or an international order in danger of fragmentation. Tonight's lecture is something of a postscript to the Miliband series on American power in the 21st century, and you are our 10th lecturer in this series. But it's most appropriate in many ways that Michael has the last word tonight. Until that is, the LSE is allowed to speak afterwards. So I look forward both to an outstanding lecture and some wonderful questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's good to be back at the LSE and so see so many old friends and some old former students as well all those years ago. Last Friday, as on most days recently in the United States, there was a funeral of a soldier. And the mother of the soldier said on that occasion, "I believe my son died not for his country, but because of his country's incoherent and uncivilized foreign policy." That's an unusual statement for a grieving mother to make. It's my judgment, too. And in fact, she chose the word incoherent, which is the first word of my title. And though I have to confess that I also have severe moral doubts about American foreign policy, amounting to her other word, uncivilized, I tried to keep that out of my book. My book is not a moral denunciation of anything the United States does, but rather a kind of quasi-realist account of how this foreign policy, this would-be empire, cannot work. Is self-destructive, causes enormous blowback and damage to the world and to the United States, and incidentally also to the United Kingdom. Let me say one or two words about the second word of my title, empire. Now, obviously, the United States has been the dominant power in the world ever since 1945. And there are different ways of expressing this domination. If we think of the word empire, traditionally we've generally thought of there being two types of empire, direct or formal on the one hand, and indirect or informal on the other. Now, direct formal empire is where you conquer a country, make it a colony. you conquer it, you reconstruct it, you form with local allies the new government, and you rule it, supposedly permanently. Now, the US has done that. It did that in the Philippines at the beginning of the 20th century, ruling it for 30-odd years. It was one of the last of the European empires. But this direct, formal empire hasn't really been experienced as a permanent thing since 1950, since the American occupation, well, the Allied occupation of Germany and Japan wound down. It was replaced, and American domination was based on something that's usually called indirect empire. And that's where you essentially limit the possibilities of foreign governments to rule. You limit what they can do, but you rule indirectly through local clients. The essential, the core feature of the American domination indirect empire in the what we now call the south of the world was that there always were strong local clients whom the US used to make sure that American wishes were fulfilled in certain ways. It always had strong local allies. Indeed, in the South, it generally took the lines of a class kind of divide. US allies were certainly the propertied classes, and it might be a genuinely popular regime, and it might have the masses, but it always had the propertied classes, and the threat came from the propertyless. The threat often allied with the Soviet Union and occasionally China. So in those cases, there was an indirect empire. You essentially ruled through local clients, something that has found in previous history as well. But Germany and Japan, 1945 to 1950, were distinct cases. It was a direct empire, direct rule, General MacArthur, the shogun of Japan, but it was only temporary. And this is essentially what the new escalation in American foreign policy is: a temporary territorial empire. It's also limited in extent. It only concerns particularly dangerous parts of the world when viewed from Washington, and they are two. There's one particular problem in Northeast Asia of North Korea, and there's a more major problem in the Middle East, which expands outwards to much of the Muslim world. These are the areas in which the US began to play with the idea of a more aggressive foreign policy. And of course, it was able to do so essentially by the collapse of the Soviet Union becoming the sole superpower. Through the 1990s, this didn't start with George Bush, through the 1990s, the sense that, well, there are enemies out there who we should be more aggressive in destroying grew, and so did the belief that we have the capacity to destroy them. The notion of the rogue states was devised under the Clinton administration, and they generally have numbered about 9, narrowed down, of course, to the seriously rogue ones in the Bush administration, the axis of evil, the 3 states, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. And the notion was that these rogues were dangerous because they sponsored terrorism, because they proliferated weapons of mass destruction, which was the most serious concern in the 1990s, and they also weren't particularly nice either as regimes, but on the other hand, so were most of our allies, not very nice, so that wasn't the crucial thing. It was weapons of mass destruction led the way. And this was a genuine concern, and the American foreign policy establishment, especially those concerned with the Pentagon, began to desire for tougher measures against these rogue states. It was, of course, 9/11 which gave them the opportunity. 3,000 people were killed, almost 3,000 on American soil. It's worth pointing out that in all former international wars, there had only been 6 casualties on the territorial, on the continental soil of the United States. That excludes Hawaii. During World War II, Japanese had let off some balloons from the beaches of Japan, packed with explosives below. The prevailing winds were intended to push them west to the east to the United States. Several of them did land in the United States, and one of them landed in Oregon, where a church picnic party had the misfortune to find them and were attracted by them, opened them, and they blew up. And six of them were killed. And they were the only casualties in any international war in the continental United States. None in World War I, none in Korea, none in Vietnam. This is the tremendous shock and a possibility for mass mobilization behind a more aggressive policy. It's something that very few foreigners can really appreciate about how sincere and general was the desire for retaliation, revenge, perfectly normal human emotion, coming from an unexpected feeling of vulnerability. And this enabled an administration to override the normal American unconcern with foreign policy, because Americans are generally not interested in foreign adventurism. Enable them to mobilize it. I'm not saying in any way they created it, but they're able to mobilize it and get popular support behind a more aggressive policy. And we know the consequences of that. Now, that was surrounded by something called, the new policy of the United States was surrounded by something called the new imperialism. This is not something that's preached by politicians themselves, who are more cautious, but intellectuals around the White House talked about how the United States had more power than any state in the world since the Roman Empire at the time of after the Second Punic War. Vastly more power than Great Britain ever had, vastly more power than any previous empire ever had. They had some support, as it were, from Greeks at the court of the Romans. I mean the expatriate Brits like myself. The historians, Paul Kennedy, wrote an article with the title "The Greatest Superpower Ever." Neil Ferguson of Columbia University urged the U.S. to take on the global imperial burden formerly shouldered by Great Britain. That's why I call them Greeks at the court of Rome. Now, I could quote many of the neoconservatives saying, "We have this empire, we have the power, therefore we ought to do it." Now, American motives for being more aggressive are mixed, as foreign policy motives usually are. And I don't want to go into motives. Considering Iraq, for example, some of them are not so legitimate motives, like oil, revenge. Some of them are the cold geopolitical motives, replacing Saudi Arabia with Iraq as the main base, defending our closest ally, which of course is not the United Kingdom, but Israel. And some more genuine motives, getting rid of probably the most terrible dictator in the world, and perhaps even being able to bring some semblance of democracy to Iraq. These motives are mixed up, as they usually are. But underlying them all is a tremendous confidence that we could do it, so we should. We could do it, right? It's as simple as that, when you get down to it. And this is what Tony Blair obviously also thought, that the US could do it, and so it was better to be on the American side than against America. And what he and people in the US felt was the Europeans didn't matter because we could do it, it would be successful, and then they'd have to come around because they've got Iraqi debts and they want the oil, etc. Well, I knew in advance that this would be completely disastrous, and I wasn't the only one who knew that, but I think I was probably the only one who did so because of comparative and historical sociology. My previous work, I've achieved some stature in predicting the past, and now I was going to turn to predicting the future, and I think I've done pretty well. If you read the book, I've done remarkably well, actually. I've surprised myself in terms of the way things have turned out, more or less, as I say they will. But what I knew from my previous work in comparative and historical sociology is two very general things. Firstly, my model of the sources of social power says that in order to possess power generally in society, you need some combination of four kinds of power: ideological, economic, military, and political. Ideological, economic, military, and political. You can go light on one or two of them, perhaps, but you need some combination of them. And what became obvious that the US was relying overwhelmingly on one form of power, military power. The second point is that I knew, in some dim sense, that this was not the age of empires. It was the age of nation states and of nationalism and anti-imperialism, the ideologies of that political form. So I knew that the times were not propitious politically and ideologically for this venture. Now, of course, I know that in this little area called Western Europe, you've moved a little beyond the nation states, right? And I also know, more relevantly to this topic today, is that much of the world hasn't got as far as the nation state. It's true that the 191 member states of the United Nations all claim sovereignty over a territory in the name of the people or nation, and therefore, in a sense, formally, are defined as nation states. But of course, many of them have very minimal control, or they're riven by disputes about who the true nation is. Many peoples in the world would dearly love to have a functioning nation state. But the ideological point is that's the dominant ideology of our world. When people talk about globalization eroding or transcending the power of the nation state, that only has a very limited truth in one or two areas, in the economy and in some areas of culture. But actually, if globalization is replacing the nation state, when was this era of nation states? Well, in Europe, you might say that it was the 19th and early 20th century. But that's not true for the world. The world was ruled by empires. Virtually every European nation state, and then the US and Japan, acquired their empires. The world was divided into empires. Those empires only finally departed in 1991, when the last of them, the Russian Empire, collapsed. So the age of empires lasted until the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. So anything subsequent to that, nation states perhaps, is rather more recent. It's still with us. We're at the beginning of the period of nation states. Okay. There'll be lots of arguments about that general point, but you're going to see the way I'm going to use it. So for those two reasons, I knew that this was going to be counterproductive. Now I'm going to go through American powers very briefly, some of them, and I'm going to focus especially on Iraq. I have to focus on something because of time constraints. There are chapters in this book on Afghanistan, the war on terrorism, the more general problem of weapons of mass destruction, etc. But I'll focus on Iraq. Now, if we think very briefly of economic power, the US is, of course, declining relatively to other world blocs and has been doing so for quite some time. It was absolutely dominant in the early 50s. It's not quite so dominant now, but it still has enough for this kind of foreign policy. The reserve currency is very useful for us. I mean, you lend us money, especially poor countries who have to keep their reserves in dollars. I'm very grateful that you subsidize my ability to live in Los Angeles beyond my means, going into debt, as all Americans are heavily into debt. Long may this continue. And it will continue for quite a while. The policy would have to reach such levels of cost and devastation before other parts of the world abandon the dollar as a reserve currency. The US clearly has the money to do it. There is a slight weakness in that Americans are not too keen on higher taxes. And next year, when the Iraqi budget comes through, Congress almost certainly will seek loans rather than grants, and will trim around the edges a bit more than now. So the economic problem is not that there isn't the wealth, but that we're a bit mean about it. But it's military that emboldened the United States. Now, nuclear weapons at the moment don't count if you want to acquire territory, because you acquire radioactive territory if you use them. Except that I should point out that my own university, the University of California, and its Livermore laboratories is developing battlefield nuclear weapons, weapons that can penetrate deep bunkers without supposedly devastating the atmosphere around. And so in 5 to 10 years, nuclear weapons will be relevant to invading other countries. However, it is offensive firepower that the US has an unrivaled, absolutely unrivaled preeminence in. We saw in Afghanistan and then in Iraq that what's called the Revolution in Military Affairs, the RMA, the Revolution in Military Affairs, had created this new generation of smart bombs linked to very complex communication systems, satellites in space, planes flying at 40,000 feet, spotters on the ground, all directing weapons of precision against enemy targets, meaning that we could destroy the enemy, suffering virtually no losses ourselves, supposedly also without causing civilian casualties, though that record is... the casualties have been less than they would have been with the old generation of weapons, but nonetheless they've been substantial. And we saw in Iraq that Iraqis were just destroyed before they ever came into range, before the Iraqis ever came into range. It's true of planes, it's true of tanks, artillery, it's true of the M16, M4 rifle that the US infantryman has. Now, there is a bit of a weakness in the military armory. It's what you do after you conquer the enemy forces, once you defeat the enemy forces. The logic of warfare is that in order to defeat the enemy in battle, you concentrate your forces. If you've got firepower advantage, you don't need as many as the enemy. And so Donald Rumsfeld was quite right that under 100,000 troops could defeat the enemy. But then you have to pacify the country. And if you're doing it yourself, which I'll come on to later, the problem whether you are or not, if you're doing it yourself, I calculated on the basis of 19th century empires that you needed at least 2.5 times the number of troops to pacify a country that you did to defeat its armies in the first place. Because you have to then disperse the forces all over the country. They also become more vulnerable. They're dispersed in patrols and small garrisons. Well, it looks at first sight as if the US has rather a massive army. 1.45 million men and women under arms. But actually, that suddenly reduces by a very substantial factor if you ask the question, how many of them can be deployed and supported for a long period of time abroad? And the answer to that is 174,000. 174,000 can be deployed abroad for a long time with all the logistical support. Now, there are at present, it's often said there are 130,000 American troops in Iraq. No, there are 116,000. 116,000 troops in Iraq, US troops. There are 8,000 in Afghanistan. There are 36,000 in South Korea. There are at least 5,000, nobody seems to know the exact number, spread out on the 132 countries with US military installations in them. They're spread out in small numbers. Every American embassy is now heavily fortified with a small number of Marines there. These add up. When you add up those figures, you come to 170,000. The US doesn't have more soldiers available for Iraq. Furthermore, of that 116 soldiers, only half of them, 58,000, are actually combat soldiers. The other half are technicians for the helicopters and everything else, and they're working in the PX, and they're doing all kinds of things. They're manning the computers. So that's gone down to 58,000. For comparative purposes, it's worth noting that there are 39,000 police officers who are members of the NYPD, the New York Police Department. There are 39,000 policemen in New York. There are 58,000, not all that many more, spread over Iraq. Now, if you divide that 58,000 into three shifts, you know, they can't be out there patrolling and catching people 24 hours a day, you get under 20,000. So we're in a bit of trouble in terms of numbers, and there aren't any more numbers. That's a particular weakness, but it's a weakness that derives from something else. And I now move on to political power relations. Now, of course, the US went into Iraq unilaterally, except for the Brits and 2,000 Australians and 59 Poles, and Poland was rewarded with 48 F-16 jet fighters a few months later. Now, when people say the US went in unilaterally, they generally mean without the Europeans, without the UN, without Russia, without Japan. Well, that's true, but I don't think that's the decisive thing. Washington wanted more, but it said, well, it doesn't matter, we can do without it. They're irrelevant. They can't defend themselves. They can't, you know, their weapons systems can't be coordinated. They're a military worm, as the Belgian foreign minister once said of Europe. They're irrelevant. It doesn't matter. And indeed, Europe and the UN would have been irrelevant had it been successful. Okay? Unilateralism in that sense could have worked. If it had worked, then that's fine. We did it. And everyone else would come running to us afterwards. No, the unilateral problem was going into a country without any local allies on the ground, apart from the Kurds in the north. And the Kurds in the north do have effective control over their areas. They already had effective control, and so they can reconstruct their part of Iraq. Now, this is almost a historical first. An attempt to have a territorial empire, however temporary, without any local allies. Now, it is possible in some cases that the British or the French would go into some territory only with their own troops. But it's much more normal for them to have local allies. And if they didn't immediately have them, they'd immediately got them. It's essentially because there are plenty of people locally, local power brokers, who would look at the relative balance of power of the two sides, the British and the ruler they were attacking, think, who's likely to win, who should I side with? Or to side with the person who wins. So they come. Clients come. I mean, how did Cortes conquer Mexico? Essentially with the aid of the Tlaxcalans, I've never been sure how to pronounce that, and other city-states who were part of the Aztec Confederate Empire. But the US was going just with a bunch of Iraqi emigres who had no significant networks of patrons and clients on the ground. And this was quite distinctive and extremely dangerous. And so, in the aftermath of Iraq, it turns out it was an important weakness not to go in with Europe and the UN and other powers. But the more important weakness was going without any local allies. And this seemed to indicate a kind of complete ignorance of history and empires. Now, of course, this is often said, so far what I've said are regarded as mistakes. Yes, we didn't have enough troops in the aftermath, but we don't have any more troops, I've said. We went in without local allies, but there aren't any. Saddam was doing a kind of extremely ruthless kind of balancing act of the various groups. No important organized groups, apart from the Kurds in the north, existed who were capable of immediately governing their areas and who would look at the US in a favorable light. Now, the point of the numbers is that the numbers in previous empires were not made up by the British or the French. They were made up by the locals. In India, the Indian army was around about 250,000, 270,000 strong for over a century. But only 50,000 to 70,000 of them were British. The others were Indians. 9/10 of the civil administration was Indian. In Africa, there were typically only 10% British troops, 90% Africans. The Germans were the empire that had the most Germans, about 40%, and they were the least effective colonists because for pacification, for repression and the like, the locals are much better at it. They have local knowledge, they have spies, they have networks, etc. So that the problem of numbers is essentially because there were no Iraqis, apart from the Kurds. Well, why not? Why couldn't there be allies? Well, now we move on to ideological power. Things have changed greatly since the Age of Empires. In the Age of Empires, there was no such thing as nationalism. So when you invaded a region of Africa, there was no broad identity which was a powerful source of resistance and which could call those who assisted the colonial power traitors or collaborators, because nationalism didn't exist amongst them. Now, when nationalism did come to exist, helped greatly by European ideas, then the empires were finished, with the aid of world wars among the empires, of course. Now, the crucial thing that's changed is that there is now nationalism as a dominant ideology in the world. Well, you might respond to that by saying, well, yes, but Iraq isn't really a case of that, because Iraq is a case where there are rival local ideologies. And that's true. There is a kind of Iraqi nationalism, generally took rather secular forms, which Saddam cultivated, tried to exaggerate the legacy with the old empires, the Akkadian and other empires of the past. That's a kind of secular nationalism that, as you find in most Middle Eastern countries, a comparable form of it. But there's also religious sources of identity. And they are usually broader than the single nation state. And they're divided, Sunni and Shia, in this country. And they have been divided for many centuries. And within them, there are all kinds of clan and tribal groupings. So it might be said, and people in Washington did say this beforehand, they said, well, we can play them off against each other. We can get supporters. We can use the Shia against the Sunni, and all kinds of tribal leaders will come to us, and they'll want the resources that we have. And to some extent, that's true. They do have some people who will come forward. But at the same time, all of these groups that I mention do share an associated ideology, which is the ideology of anti-imperialism. And so it's very difficult for people to collaborate with the Americans if it is only an American force, because this is an alien and oppressive and imperial power. Empire is no longer popular. Now, the problem, there are other ideological problems too. I mean, one of them that a lot of people point out is we now have weapons of mass communication around the world. Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and other Arabic channels and newspapers, the like, consumed on a mass basis by people in Iraq. And that was denied people in the 19th century. So things have changed because the mass media of communication are now stacked against the imperialists too. It doesn't help that American foreign policy for many years has looked very imperial to many Muslims. I mean, if one recounts the number of features, if one thinks, for example, of bin Laden's three consistent criticisms of the US in all the statements he made in the 1990s. Sometimes he adds on a little bit here and there, but the three are essentially the US occupation of Saudi Arabia with its holy sites, its support for Israel stroke Zionists stroke Jews, sometimes he uses one term, sometimes another, and thirdly, the invasions and bombings of Iraq from 1991 onwards. Now, these all look like expressions of imperialism. Then we have the invasion of Afghanistan, killing about 10,000 Afghans. Then the invasion and occupation of Iraq, killing so far anywhere between 15 and 20,000 Iraqis. Then we have the minor things, the more minor things on, when viewed on this scale. Guantanamo Bay, 660 prisoners still there without any legal rights whatever, against the better judgment of the rest of the world. Then the new anti-immigration laws in the US. Men aged 16 and over from 26 countries who are immigrants all have to report to the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and their papers are then examined, and so is their criminal record. And since lots of immigrants in the US are illegal, many of them are violated there. So they're either deported or incarcerated, not in Guantanamo Bay, but indefinitely without any legal rights. Now, of those 26 countries, North Korea is not Muslim. The other 25 countries are all Muslim countries. Now, for 4 days in December 2002, another country was included, along with Azerbaijan at the same time. They were added at the same time. That country was Armenia. The INS is not very knowledgeable about the world. The Armenian ambassador and two Armenian-American congressmen immediately said four simple words, "But we are Christians." So they were removed from the list. Well, the State Department has a list of proscribed terrorist organizations. Some of them date from the past, from a long time. There are still some communist ones or ex-communist ones in the Philippines. There's the IRA, the Basque ETA, a few like that. There are Colombian leftists. But even with their presence, over two-thirds of these organizations are Muslim ones. It's essentially a war against Muslim terrorism. Now, all of these things that I've just listed, I'm not primarily listing them as atrocities in any way. Instead, I'm just pointing out you can read about them all on the websites of Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and the various Arabic newspapers. Okay, and I quote a lot of them in my book. And so Iraq, as in many countries in the Muslim world, is fed a diet of anti-American imperialism. When I say fed, I mean they're fed facts. These are all true things. Every time that civilians, that photographers can get close to civilian casualties in Afghanistan or Iraq, then the pictures are beamed around the Middle East. This is not made up, but it's obviously something that reinforces the anti-imperialism. So, in all kinds of ways, this is not the age of empire. As the US is forced to act on its own with military power alone, it also obviously contradicts its own values that it's fighting for: freedom, democracy, bringing wealth to countries. And so the ideological contradictions are severe. The militarism contradicts them, The overall effect of this is extreme incoherence. Iraq is a terrible mess. I said, you know, when you it takes them 6 months to publish a book, I said then that the American casualties would be at 1 to 2 a day. This is in the beginning of May. 1 to 2 a day until the next US election in November 2002. Well, I mean, it might have been more, it might have been better, it might have been less. But it is a mess. And the problem is that very few Iraqis will collaborate with the Americans. The US is forced to bomb the place from the air, to bomb buildings from the air. That's a sign of weakness, not of strength. It doesn't look to me as if it's going to get better. People can argue different ways. You never know. There might be some movement among the Shia. I mean, the Shia have their own agenda. It seems that the most organized Sunni are hostile to the US. Most organized Shia, they're factionalized, have their own agenda, which is not pro the US. On the other hand, certainly not pro the Sunni either. And so there may be some movement, and the US may be able to cobble something together. But that doesn't look very likely. It doesn't look very likely that any other foreign powers are going to add significant numbers of troops there. Nor are they in Afghanistan. There was recently a call by the UN in Afghanistan for 3,000 foreign troops. The Norwegians responded with 200, and that's all. Violence is increasing, though from quite a low base, in Afghanistan. There are also blowback effects elsewhere on weapons of mass destruction. CIA reports reveal that North Korea and Iran have both been going more quickly towards the acquisition of nuclear weapons. And wouldn't you too? If the US had been successful in Iraq, then they could be next. They would be next. They would have been next for a lot of pressure. Better to have nuclear weapons. As one State Department official said, what's the difference between Saddam and Kim Jong-il? Saddam doesn't have one, and look what's happening to him. But of course, there's another reason for them rushing at this time, which is that the US can do nothing whatever about them at the moment, because it's completely fully engaged. Its forces are fully engaged. And so though it threatens, it also, for the first time in during the Bush administration, it's been conciliatory as well, because it can't do anything else. It's now agreed with the Europeans to go through a quieter UN route than a sanctions route. And the US has been pressed by South Korea and China and Japan to try and do a deal with North Korea. Now, in any case, invading countries is an extremely expensive way of eradicating the world of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. It's much cheaper to buy them out, much cheaper to resort to the Clinton strategy, which was subverted when, on the American side, when eventually there was a Republican majority in Congress in 1996 or 8, I don't remember which, and then the US could no longer carry on giving fuel and promising trade to North Korea. And the work on the nuclear reactors was stopped, on the non-weaponized nuclear reactors. But clearly, the sensible strategy with weapons of mass destruction is not to try and invade countries if you don't really have the capacity to do so. There's no reason for expecting that Iran or even Syria would be any easier as invading targets. And though Korea is very different with the South Korean client state there, the client state doesn't want it because its capital is within artillery range of the North Korean forces. So, terrible blowback effects there. The war on terrorism. There's a fundamental mistake in the war on terrorism, not making a distinction between national and international terrorists. International terrorists are the ones attacking us. National terrorists are the ones attacking a local enemy, like Hamas, Hezbollah. They haven't attacked any Americans since the early 1980s, when the US was actually, US troops were in the Lebanon, which is where Hezbollah's bases are. When Colin Powell makes statements against terrorism, he normally talks about Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah. But these are seen in much of the Muslim world as national liberation movements, fighting against their local enemy. There's no reason whatever to put Al-Qaeda with them. One is attacking as the other is not. International terrorism, Al-Qaeda, is a very small organization which could be easily defeated. We're told by experts on them in the 1990s, like Gilles Kepel and Olivier Roy, that the core of the jihadis was weakening through the mid-1990s. And of course, Al-Qaeda is composed of emigres, people who had to flee from their own state, their own country, because they're not strong enough to take on Saudi Arabia or Egypt or the Yemen. They fled to safer territories. They were very much boosted by the Soviet war in Afghanistan, and now they're being boosted again by the American wars. So it's easy to get full international cooperation against international terrorists, because almost every time they let off a bomb, they kill more locals than they do Westerners. And so successively around the world, we're seeing other governments come into line in trying to get at international terrorists. Indonesia after Bali, Morocco after Casablanca, and now Turkey. If we're able to separate international from national terrorists, we'd be able to defeat it in relatively short time. But the US is creating more of them by a kind of war that's perceived by more and more Muslims as being a war against them. Well, these are the reasons why it's a disastrous foreign policy, why it's counterproductive, why the US is either going to cut and run in Iraq, leaving in Iraq in a terrible state with probably civil war, or it'll keep some bases there, try and establish some local government and foray out every time the Sunni resistance becomes open. If we don't cut and run, well, I think that if Americans can't keep getting on killed until November 2002, that's a very good reason why Bush would lose the election. Let's be optimistic and say that one way or another, this policy will soon be over. What then? Well, it's very bad news for Iraq, and it's not very good news for the Middle East as a whole. It's something that leaves the Middle East much more divided, because, of course, I don't want to blame all the problems in the Middle East on the US. I mean, the region has enormous problems of internal conflict, but it's going to leave those problems worsened. It's going to leave weakened some formerly reliable or half-reliable American states, client states like Saudi Arabia. But for the rest of the world, it won't leave much of a trace. I mean, you know, American foreign policy didn't actually harm Europe or Japan or Russia or China. So if we go back to the normal level of American dominance, then the world can do that without too much trouble, apart from the Middle East. Now, what's generally called multilateralism, the multilateralism of the 1990s, was about as good as the US can get, really, because take the UN. I mean, if the US wanted the UN to act, the UN acted. If the US didn't want the UN to act, then there was no action. And, you know, what's called multilateralism is clearly American leadership of an alliance. An alliance which has some unpleasant sides. I mean, the US is in general blamed for its neoliberalism in relation to the South. But, of course, this is a common northern policy. I mean, you know, the European agricultural policy or the policy of the northern bank, of the European banks, is not really different from that of the United States. So there's a common north exploitation of the south, and there are commonalities over most of foreign policy. So the world will probably go back to this American domination, which in the medium term will gradually decline as China and India and finally Russia begins to recover, and there is a more genuinely multilateral world. But of course, for a long time to come, the US will remain the military power. And so if you want any kind of what's called humanitarian interventionism, it has to be done with the help of American forces or there is no intervention. That always has to be remembered. But if we are going to go, the escalation in the 1990s under Clinton was this notion of humanitarian intervention, and if we go back to that and escalate it further, we should remember the three primary characteristics of such interventions which Iraq lacked. The first is your motives have to look good. They have to look disinterested. The second is it's better to have UN legitimacy. And the third and most important one is that you have to have some reasonable local government on the ground that you can replace the existing one that's contravening human rights with a better one. That's clearly what we had in Bosnia and Kosovo. It's what could have been there in Rwanda, but it's not there in Iraq. Thank you.
Lecture that would be hard to better, and an extraordinary reflection of many years of deep and profound work and scholarship. But a controversial lecture nonetheless, not necessarily keeping separate the empirical and the normative, as Michael might hope, but it'd be interesting to see how the audience picks up on this. We usually take questions in clusters of five, so when those who have to leave have left, if you could do so straight away, that would be excellent. Our roaming mics should come into the room, upstairs and downstairs. Excellent. I'd like to take the first five clusters of questions. If I may just abuse my role for a moment and be selective, I would like to ask perhaps one or two of the past contributors to this series who've taken very different views, if they would like to say something by way of a question to begin with. So, looking at one or two of them, I don't know whether you would like Mick to take this opportunity, Mick Cox of the LSE.
I've been spotted.
Thank you, Michael. Firstly, I should say I've actually bought your book, so please treat me gently. I do agree with most of what you said. I mean, the only question I raised really, and we're going to talk about this later on, is I wonder if by focusing on Iraq, which is such a complete mess, all the reasons you've given, and there are many more, and this is part of the American debate now, by focusing on what is clearly a foreign policy disaster, you're looking at the conjunctural situation caused by it. I mean, if I might quote somebody else from LSE, Susan Strange, I mean, you're talking about conjuncture, but you're not talking much about the structure, it seemed to me. I mean, you brought it in at a certain point, but I just wondered if by looking at some more detail at some of the structural forms of American power, you might end up with a rather different picture of something you've painted, which is actually extraordinarily weak, flabby. It is bound to be defeated in some respects. Now, I just wonder, the focus on Iraq is bound to lead you to the sorts of conclusions you've arrived at. I mean, if you were to say, look at international institutions and the role of the United States within those, I wonder if, in fact, you might not arrive at rather different conclusions. So simply the focus of your lecture is bound to lead to the type of conclusions that you did. We can also discuss the question of empire. I mean, I just think it's a useful historical sociological comparative tool of analysis, and it's a good way of getting around the notion that there's an American exceptionalism. And I think it just is a useful historical tool of analysis to find both similarities and differences. I agree with some of the things you said about it. But anyway, I've been spotted. I've made a couple of points. I wasn't ready for that one, David, but
no,
you are mean. You are mean.
Mary. Mary Caldo.
Well, I do, of course, agree with you, and I'm somebody who was greatly influenced by your work, and I managed to receive the book for free. So it's sitting on my desk. But what surprised me in your whole analysis was actually how realist you were as somebody who's deeply influenced by you. What surprised me was that you didn't talk about the domestic sources of power. If we really look at the weaknesses that you admirably demonstrate in the case of Iraq, isn't there a problem that in earlier wars, at the heyday of the nation state, war would lead to increases in taxes, not tax cuts? people would be willing to risk their lives, you could introduce conscription. And so the real question is about the domestic weaknesses of the United States as much as it is about the weakness of their ability to impose their power in Iraq.
Yeah. Okay. That's the end of the boost. Now I will just randomly select. Please just say who you are and where you're from and ask a question. So, one mic over there. And then I'll take your question, yeah. A question.
Yes, I mean, you say that this is the age of nationalism and the nation state, but isn't the history really of the, since the Second World War, when you look at the ANC, the PLO, all the national liberation struggles, in fact, not one of them has been able to create a viable national state that's independent of the international economy and to, in any shape or form, go on a national road?
Thank you. There was a question up there on the left.
Hello. You talked about the possibility of the US cutting and running from Iraq. Would you consider the situation in Afghanistan sort of semi-cutting and running, because there is now no media attention or U.S. policy government attention on Afghanistan at all? So is that what might possibly happen, just a slow fading out rather than a dramatic exit?
Thanks. Hi, Adam Quinn, LSE. To play devil's advocate and be a bit of a pedant with your title, given that in Iraq, even the most rabid neoconservatives' primary goal is to create an independent nation-state in Iraq and then get as many American troops out as possible, and that most of the problems that have occurred are to do with how much they've had to postpone Iraqi independence with the withdrawal of troops, in what sense is that policy imperial? And also, given that there does seem to be a very clear idea that what they want is creation of an independent state, maximum withdrawal of American troops, although that's very practically difficult to implement, in what sense is it incoherent?
Okay, that was the fifth question of this batch, so we'll give Michael a chance to respond.
Okay, well, that's a number of issues, the ones that are more concrete. Afghanistan, from immediately it ended, I thought that the U.S. wanted to be able to put Karzai in a position where he'd be able to kind of last 6 months after we left, and they haven't been able to do that yet. Yes, Afghanistan is not a tremendous success story, but of course it's of no very little, almost no strategic value. It has nothing of any significance. So the U.S. would be more likely to cut and run there than in Iraq if things got worse there, I think. Yes, I mean, is it imperial because they want a nation state? Yeah, I mean, I accept what you say, and it's only, I hoped I made it clear, it's only a temporary territorial imperialism, and then you leave, you hope to have created a more viable nation state, yes. I don't have any problem with that. Nation states being actually weak, yes, indeed. what you say is true, but the ideologies of nationalism and anti-imperialism remain, and we actually saw the latter at Cancun in that respect, and that I think is something that is going to grow, actually. I don't think that there aren't many effective nation states around the world, I agree with that, but it doesn't alter my stress on the hegemony of nationalism and anti-imperialism as ideologies in the south of the world. Mary's point about, yes, I didn't talk about domestic weaknesses. You're right, and I mean, Bin Laden always said that the U.S. can't stomach casualties, and our culture has changed, and we need separate professional soldiers now. We can't recruit young men who will just go and fight because of the traditional authoritarianism of the society and all of that. So, yes. Well, I wanted, I mean, you know, this is adopting a realist framework for political, partly for political reasons, of course. You know, you say it can't work, and
that's the line of the book. Conjunctural rather than structural from Mick there, right. well, I think that both are necessary, and you know, when I look at the development of American foreign policy, there are obviously some deep running tendencies going in opposite directions. One, the relative decline of American power in other than the military sense, but two, the growth of an apparent military come political ability to dominate international institutions, and especially with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And those are tendencies. But I think that, I mean, as I say in my book, it requires three, you know, rather accidental things to emerge with this outcome. One is the Hanging Chads of Florida. Second is that Bush asked Cheney to head his transition team. And he essentially, and Bush had no experience in foreign policy, he staffed the transition team with former Pentagon people who were very knowledgeable about the revolution in military affairs and were varieties of neoconservatives, just hardliners wanting revenge, pro-Likud right, and you know, one or two evangelicals as well. And then the third thing is 9/11. And I don't think the Clinton administration would have done this, and I don't think the Bush would have done this without 9/11. I mean, you know, Cheney was wanting it, but I don't think they would have done it. So it's a kind of combination of the two. But you say, is Iraq... Is Iraq extreme? Well, Afghanistan, I didn't talk about Afghanistan. It's no better. The war on terrorism is no better. We're losing the war on terrorism. The U.S. does dominate international institutions, should dominate, should normally dominate institutions, and it's losing a bit of that in consequence. I think that's it, isn't it?
Well, as the chair, I really do feel I should apologize for the heat in here. You're feeling hot and about to pass out. You're not alone. But there's still lots of time for another cluster of questions. And if anyone who was unhappy with his answers wants to come back, please do. But let me take five different people to begin with. I'll take two or three from here and two or three from upstairs.
My question is about the term empire. Although you use some terms like temporary territorial empire, it seems that the United States doesn't like to be resident in the places it occupies. It is not an empire in residence. As a socialist, I wonder what you see as the sociological underpinnings of this approach. Secondly, when you said there is no client in Iraq, I covered this country starting from early 90s, and I was there recently as well. Actually, there is a government in the making there. It's not because they want to collaborate with the United States, but because they see their interests in that. And the reason... I mean, one example is that they recently made U.S. accept that Turkey shouldn't send troops there. So they have certain power. And finally, about Al-Qaeda, you said Al-Qaeda can be defeated if we make a distinction between local and international terrorism, whereas Al-Qaeda seems to me to be a confederation of fundamentalist terrorist networks with unity in ideology and objectives. So when that is the case, how can you divide them and defeat?
Thank you. Just on
next. To what extent do you think U.S. corporate interests are driving this foreign policy?
U.S.
Corporate interests.
Hard to see it, yeah. Over there, question over there. And then we'll come upstairs. Do you all justice?
I was wondering, you seem fairly confident that the U.S. will return to this dominance in terms of leading military alliances after, say, this cut and run from Iraq. But I'm not so convinced, especially after deciding to dedicate $87 billion and also could you qualify how you think that the military might not necessarily be as well equipped to handle humanitarian interventions, considered the percentage of American military spending that is devoted to developing new weapons of mass destruction, as opposed to transitioning the military to more humanitarian intervention-oriented goals?
Great question.
I found your view on collaborating with clients very interesting. So my question is, would it have been more efficient for the United States to collaborate with Saddam Hussein just like it did with Hirohito after the war in Japan?
Okay. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Yes. What role do you think America's self-perception plays in its foreign policy? It seems to me that most Western governments have a pretty cynical view about their own government's foreign policy, and it doesn't seem to be reflected in opinion poll research I've seen in the States. And just for example, the latest Pew Attitude survey showed that most Americans think that their foreign policy towards Israel is even-handed, whereas not even most Israelis believe that. And I just wonder how your lectures and books go down in the States. I mean, the audience is... Do they listen to what you're saying, or are they kind of immune from what you're saying?
Thank you. Well, we'll have time for another cluster in a moment.
Okay. Right. Yes, I wouldn't like to be seen as putting down the Iraqis of the provisional... of the council who are attempting to reconstruct the country. I think, however, that their biggest problem is being seen as collaborators with the US. Now, if this had been a UN operation, of course it couldn't be because the UN wouldn't have given that authority, but supposing it had been, and it had been a genuinely multilateral one, and the states all around would have said to their citizens, well, we might not like to see Iraq invaded, but the world wants it, and so we have to do it, and all of that kind of thing. And then if there had been actually Arab troops there, then it would be possible. It would be a lot more possible. The difficulty is that in reconstructing Iraq, it's difficult. You can only do it under American terms, though you're right, they are bargaining over one or two things. And that's the major problem. The U.S. should have collaborated with Saddam. Okay, if you can't overthrow him, well, sorry, we may be able to kill him. We may have overthrown him. But if we can't produce a better situation, then we should do something else. And we it's interesting here that this isn't only a Bush failing, this is a Clinton failing too. It was Madeleine Albright who first said that the point of sanctions is to produce a rising within Iraq. The notion was you starve Iraqis and there will be a rising against Saddam. And that has been not a good policy from the beginning. And so I think, yes, you have to deal with these people, you do deals with them, you make them offers, and you get things in return for them. U.S. corporate interests, well, they're obviously there, and they color the past and the perceptions of some of the Republican administration. I mean, they do. When in opposition, they have senior business positions, some of them in oil and in oil ancillary industries. And there is a military-industrial complex, one which has a particular relationship to Israel. I don't see this as a rational strategy, and so I don't see it as having rational corporate goals. Obviously it's about oil, but if it was only about oil, you'd make friends with the people who have the oil and not invade them. It's a very high-risk strategy, but it's a high-risk strategy. It was taken because of their confidence that they could do it. U.S. self-perception, yes. Israel is a particular... problem in the United States. And I'm doing this kind of thing next week and for the next month in the US, and I haven't yet done it. I'll tell you that. But I don't think it'll be. I don't think it'll be difficult. I mean, I've actually already been on Fox News, that's the lion's den. But the American public opinion is now divided. It's true that very few people accept European views on Israel. But apart from that, Americans are now divided, as they were before the war. I mean, there was this particular problem. 9/11 created this self-coercing patriotism, and so the media and the Democrats didn't want to get up and say, I oppose this, because they would be denounced as, or they would be seen as being unpatriotic. Howard Dean was an unknown figure, and he was saying he's against this, but no senior Democrats were. And if you think about how the media operate, you need an opposition spokesman. If you don't have an opposition spokesman, then you've got nothing to bounce off. And so you did have this kind of year and more of various foreigners said, Eastern Europeans said, it was like being back under communism as far as the media was concerned, but it was a temporary thing. And now that all the Democrats are running opportunistically or sincerely on anti-war platforms to one degree or another, things are changing.
Well, given the hour and the heat, let's take a final cluster of brief questions. Yeah, two at the front here, let's take those together.
Oh, okay. Ladies first, she said, so I'll go. Yeah, it's hi, it's Stephen Fox from the Law Department. The question I have, well, I'm looking forward to reading the book, and maybe Mary Calder might lend me her copy. But the question I have is about your predictions in the book. How far have you predicted ahead in the future? It'll save me from reading my stars tomorrow. But the outcome could be two. You could have an interim administration set up in June next year. Everything's hunky-dory. They have their own government. Or it could be the alternative where you have an administration, some sort of interim administration. It doesn't have the legitimacy of the Iraqi people. Then it collapses, and then basically, they engage in a civil war themselves. For the Americans, if it's the latter case, what would that mean for them, the consequences of such a policy? Would they just spin it that they tried their best?
I was wondering if you like to exercise your predictive powers and speculate on how long you think nation states are going to stick around for, if it will be for as long as empires.
Yeah, these questions are all on the same theme. In your book, you take a very long-term perspective, sources of social power, from the beginning to 17, whatever it was. In this analysis tonight, you've given us a very short-term account of what's happening. So I'm wondering what these things might look like in 20, 40, 50, or 100 years, if you can bring your historical sociology to bear on what these transformations are going to look like over the medium to long term.
Okay, at the front here.
Thank you. I would answer your question differently, why there cannot be an American empire. I'd say because Americans don't want to be an empire. If you look at the imperial background of the Americans, with Roosevelt commanding the troops against the Spanish troops, regretting this act after 5 years, and if you look at the 90s at Mogadishu, where you'll see that after two soldiers die, you have to get all of the soldiers out of the country. I'd say there cannot be an empire for ideological reasons, and that is because because Americans are not ready to use their military means as the British, the Spanish, whatever, in the 19th century were ready to do. So there cannot be, because they don't want to, and there cannot be because others don't want them to do that.
And finally.
To bring it back to the current situation, I was really interested in your models of power, and I was wondering if you had any insights as to how the U.S. could move away from its overwhelming dominance on military power, and could they, say, bring to bear more economic power or some other form of power in Iraq to try and stabilize the current situation?
Before you answer, can I make just two announcements? Because I think when you finish, there'll be a rush of cooler air. So once I have a captive audience, two brief announcements. One, to announce a non-Miliband lecture, but nonetheless excellent. On Thursday, the 4th of December, here at 6:30, Old Theatre, Professor Joe Grieco on the theme of American Drift, Myths and Realities about the United States and the New World Order. And then to say, watch out for the Miliband spot on the LSE website in about a month's time, when we'll be announcing a series for next year on culture in the age of global communications, and hope to have a very original and interesting set of speakers look at the issues of nation states, nationalism, globalization, and so on, but by focusing broadly on the theme of contemporary culture and communications. So, Mick.
Well, I don't think I blew my own trumpet a little bit on short-term predictions, but I don't think I can deliver the goods on longer-term predictions. But I do think that nation states will survive a while yet. The European Union is unique in the world, and I think that nation states, their roles are changing, and many of them no longer have that military backbone, which was their historical background, but they do retain important roles, and the struggle for much of the world is to achieve them, to achieve the kind of national infrastructures on which any form of development is possible. I mean, maybe they won't, maybe the world will remain a mess in that respect. I don't know the answer to that. Yes, I mean, the Iraqi outcomes might be better. You know, it is possible that something might emerge in Iraq that makes some kind of transition, you know, towards some kind of regime, not a democratic one, but, you know, one that functions in some sense, that they can get the oil back again and that they can have a little bit of development. That might be possible. But I think that things have reached the point that in any case, this will be defined by American policymakers and certainly by British policymakers as a mistake. It's not something that will be attempted on Iran. It's not something that will be attempted on North Korea. And the question... yeah, I do think that. And the question of... yes, I mean, the question about... shouldn't the US exercise its other forms of power? Yes. I mean, in the end, I do conclude that this is not the new imperialism, but the new militarism, because it's so narrowly based. I think that, yes, I've indicated about weapons of mass destruction, American economic power could be used to much greater productivity in terms of... so far, various countries have been bought out from nuclear weapons. The Ukraine... South Africa was rather particular, Argentina, Brazil, it's possible. Of course, we can't uninvent biological and chemical weapons, though they're so far not very usable. But I think that it is only by the development of a world in which there is not so much hostility between states that you can... you can't uninvent these weapons, but you can make them less likely to be used. You know, one should always regard one's enemies, as it were, as rational human beings. One should treat them with respect, and one should try and see what their motivations are. As far as the rogue states are concerned, most of them, not all of them, most of them are seeking to acquire weapons of mass destruction because they fear the United States. And so the most productive thing that the United States could do is become friends with them and help them develop in some ways. Okay, it might mean it's not a particularly, might say it's blackmail, and well, they all pretend they're getting them, and then you buy them out. Well, that's a better scenario than the present one. I do think, however, that one thing, you know, there is some kind of optimism underlying what I'm saying, and that is that I think that the balance of power between the north of the world and the south of the world is changing in certain ways. People haven't really noticed. And there are other things that I didn't mention, like there are some things that the United States can't do in Iraq, and that Americans would be horrified if they did do, which were perfectly normal for all previous empires. And that is, you'd go into the Sunni Triangle and burn villages and deport the populations and perhaps shoot every 10th man or whatever, which is what the British Empire did and all of the other empires. They weren't nice. And, you know, the kind of, the world has changed. And Americans can't do that and don't want to do it. And, yeah, Americans don't want to be an empire of the kind that the Europeans were, but Americans are quite happy to be an indirect empire, and they were until very recently, and they would be again. And they did support this temporary notion, but I don't think they will again in the near future. And I think that in some ways, you know, American power in the world, when you compare it, you know, the kind of American hegemony, British hegemony, etc. Now, various people, including Patrick O'Brien here, have pointed out that the US today has vastly more power than its rivals, than Britain ever had. But in a way, that isn't the right comparison. What the south of the world faced in the 19th century was the combined force of the European powers, and they all looked more or less the same, and they all had the future, and the future that they wanted. And they had all of the resources. Now, the US, to be compared, if it can't bring the outcome that it wants in a quite moderately poor country of 24 million people, then there has been some change in the balance of power in the world. And that's a good thing.
And a good point to end on. So thank you very much indeed.